This is Out of the Arctic.
Hello, and welcome to Out of the Arctic, a podcast from SEARCH, the study of environmental Arctic change. In this podcast, we create an auditory window to the Arctic and explore the perspectives of Indigenous people, scientists, and public and private decision makers in the context of environmental change. In this episode, we will experience the Arctic tundra and how the Inupiaq and Western worlds interact there through the perspective of someone who has lived there for their entire life. With that, I'm Athena.
Hey everyone, this is Alex. We are really glad to have you back for another episode, and I'm really, really excited about this one.
Yeah, me too, Alex. Thanks. Today, we get the chance to hear from Cyrus Harris, a member of the Native Village of Kotzebue Tribal Council, as well as a natural resource advocate for Manilok Association. Cyrus is also a manager of a hunter support program that provides traditional foods for Kotzebue's elders.
Yeah, and that's only the tip of the iceberg. As we'll hear from him soon, Cyrus grew up living off of the Arctic tundra and the ocean next door to it, yet has now lived in Kotzebue for a long time and been experiencing the Inupiaq and Western worlds collide and coincide in Northwest Alaska.
Exactly. Alex and Cyrus talked about a lot, so let's get right into it.
Good morning. My name is Cyrus Harris. My Inupiaq name is Nonagak. I am from here in Kotzebue, Alaska, which is 30 miles above the Arctic Circle. I'm a lifelong Alaskan. I live out in the country. I grew up living out in the country. I moved into a village named Kotzebue, you know, to work and make a living. I work for Manilok Association, which is a regional organization, which represents 12 of our villages within the Manilok service area. I work for the Hunter Support Program, which is designed to keep traditional foods on the elders' table that they were raised with. So this Hunter Support Program allows able-bodied hunters and fishers to go out and harvest for our elders who no longer can harvest on their own anymore, for the health benefits of the foods that they were raised with and what they're able to continue to have. Up here in Kotzebue, we rely heavily on our coast, our oceans, our water, our rivers, and the land and the sky for our shelter and our nutrient, what we're able to live off. We didn't have a store or we didn't had a market to go out and buy the foods that we what we consume. So our garden is really out in the tundra, out in the ocean, out in the water, to where we harvest, we're able to harvest depending on the season. So to me, the most important thing within the ecosystem is the health benefits that Mother Earth's got to produce. So with all the challenges that we're facing today, with the expanding population within the world, is a high interest into coming into undisturbed territory for industry of all sorts, you know, to help benefit the rest of the world. So the challenges are, how could it safely be done? How can we protect our environment, the foods that we consume, the water, the land, and the earth? So a lot of these are discussed in many meetings that I have attended. A lot of challenges that we're also facing is climate change. So climate change, you know, takes a big effect on our ability to go out and harvest at certain times of the year, mainly springtime when we have our, when the spring thaw and travel is limited, and also fall freeze up when the ice oceans are freezing up, and we're dealing with warmer climates in between, causing prevailing east and southeast winds, which causes overflow in many areas, and the snow that's covering it before the ice gets thick enough, it covers the danger spots of the snow. So you, many times you don't know you're on it until you're sometimes often too late. So there's a lot of challenges that we face in traveling to and from today. The frequent storms that we're getting, I mean, it was this summer, we did had a couple back-to-back storms in July, which is really unheard of. Those high tide surges, they don't usually start happening until September. It was very unheard of that it happened in July. So even the weather forecast forecasted some winds, but it didn't forecast the high tide surge and alert warning to, you know, to protect your property from high waters. But it happened. You know, when I'm able to put things together, I see it that, you know, the weather changes that were, we can't predict the weather like we did before. It even got the weatherman by surprise. I'm not too sure how else to put it in better words.
So I had the pleasure to go up to Northwest Alaska for the first time last month, but I've never been to Kotzebue. And I imagine most people that might be listening to this haven't been to Kotzebue or the regions that are there. So really briefly, what's it like up there? What are the sort of traditional foods that your communities are usually asking to? And what's the space of Kotzebue and the surrounding part of Alaska and the ocean like?
It's really amazing on how rich our resources are out there. We're on a peninsula here on northwest coast of Alaska, and we're covered by, you know, oceans on both sides of us, and then of course lakes and the river systems. And on our backyard, we got a couple of the two main river systems, which is fairly large, Notak and the Kobuk. And of course, we couldn't count out the Selwyk and Buckland, the other rivers nearby, and Kivalina rivers, and they all produce a great amount of different species of fish, different species of game at certain times of the year. Most villages got their own hot spots where they, you know, go to during the springtime to harvest, just as well as the summertime and the fall time, and of course throughout the winter. So our main source of fish that we get is the salmon, which comes up on our Notak and our Kobuk rivers to spawn. So we get those every year, and they come in abundance as we speak. And the salmon, they start arriving roughly the later part of June and up until September. So that's when they're going through up into the river system. And of course, you know, we have during the fall time, we have many different species of other fish that we also consume during the fall time. Many varieties of a whitefish, we've got pike, we've got Arctic char, and many others that I couldn't just name, you know, they're just right there, great abundance. Of course, a lot of sea mammals in our ocean that we heavily rely on for our source of food throughout the winter months. Our elders before us store these foods, the sea mammals, they prepare it in a way to where it preserves itself in a source of a seal oil and dried meats, and the dried meats preserved into oil, and all of it is edible and with great nutrient value into it that helps us out in these cold, long winters. So throughout the days of winter months when you couldn't travel and go out very much or very far, we've always had that food set aside for those occasions. But in between, there's a lot of other little small animals. There's a lot of ptarmigan throughout the winter, which is a fresh bird. We have a great variety of waterfowl that do come in during the spring waterfowl migration that comes up here and bear their young and migrate back south during the fall time.
I think that ties into exactly what you were saying about how, from at least my perspective, the fact that the entire world around you is where you source your nutrition from, and where the fact that I think you said that's like your garden is the world around you. And you said that you work specifically with trying to make sure that your community's elders have access to this traditional foods, right?
Well, yeah, like I've mentioned earlier on, the program that I work for, the Hunter Support Program, well, it works in several different ways. There's a way it works for our community villages through way of allocating funds to the tribes, that with the funds, they use the funds for the hunter support, which is gasoline, motor oil, and ammunition for able-bodied hunters such as you to go out hunt for your grandma or grandpa. You know, that's a need.
Sure.
Or your grandma or grandpa might have a relative that's actively out there hunting and fishing that would allow them to go through the program, you know, for that assistance. Now, when we speak about our villages, you know, it's a really high cost of living up here in the Arctic. The only way we get some of our fuel is by plane. We do get our barge services within the coastal areas, which reduce the amount of price per gallon. Now, each village pays a certain amount per gallon. We got some villages that's paying well over $12, $15 a gallon of gas. Here in Kotzebue, we probably got a break of $5.85 a gallon, you know. So the cost of living is huge up this way. So that hunter support program really helps out the villages in that form of keeping food on the elders' table. And the other way how it operates is I work out of this building called a siglo. And this siglo is a modern day processing plant that processes wild game and sees that it's safe for the elders at the long-term care to consume. So once I do get a donation or I do go out and harvest wild game on my own, I see that it's safe enough to come into the building and process, break it down into stew meat, steaks, roast, burger, whatever you could make out of it. And of course, get a stamp on it with a date and a lenient date on it, and then deliver over to the long-term care. There are some certain foods that's that doesn't quite make it to the table, but the main sources of care, the meats and the fishes, and berries and greens, you know, they are allowable. And when I say the long-term care, it's a federally regulated building. The big challenges for this program is that we couldn't get any kind of traditional foods to our elders at the long-term care. Back in 2015, when the Farm Bill passed, in the language within the Farm Bill, it stated that wild game or traditional foods would also be included in the Farm Bill to safely process for the schools and or long-term cares. So I work for the long-term care. I work for the Elders Traditional Foods Program. So I've designed this building to make foods safe to run through the long-term care. So this building, in order to get it up and established, we needed someone from the Environmental Health Department to see to it that this building is built up to code. In other words, three-phase sink, stainless steel. When I say three-phase sinks, that's a suds, that's rinse and sanitize. So it's the same setup you would see in restaurants, but we're focusing on well game. That's going to safely make it to the long-term care. So with this program up and running, we're able to serve well game to our elders at the long-term care for them to cook at the kitchen.
So, as you're seeing this struggle in general, these challenges of working with the federal government, essentially with the Farm Bill, and that causing lots of struggles to provide food for the elders in the long-term care, but also then you also see the environment also changing. And I imagine that you mentioned climate change earlier, that it might make it more difficult just in general, whether it's for the specifically getting these foods through this federal program to the elders, but just in general, accessing the foods in general, it seems like there's a couple different challenges that are making it harder to provide food to these traditional foods to community. What sort of how have you engaged with that, and what's that like?
Yeah, you know, I've mentioned the Farm Bill kind of gave us a break into serving our food, our wild game. I also mentioned a federally regulated building, you know, which is a lot of foods that's going to be served in a building such as that needs to be USDA approved, needs to have that stamp that you would see in the market, you know, when you go and buy your meats and so forth. The nutrient labels, you know, that type of regulations is what we face because our caribou, our you know, and our wild game, our moose, our muskox, our waterfowl, we didn't have a way of stamping them out as USDA approved. You know, these were out in the field types of game that we were harvesting and taking in. But through some certain guidelines, you know, we're able to bypass that. When the Farm Bill passed, the feds decided to opt out of it and have the state take over, which is I believe the DEC, which is less restrictive than the federal regulations as far as food coming into a building. So we followed through with the state, which is the DEC, and followed their practice and purposes, you know, to run these foods to the long-term care and to the hospital.
That's great that you're able to get some of the foods in eventually, but I can imagine that all those hurdles you have to jump through, like you said, getting it USDA approved just doesn't, it makes sense for something coming from a farm in Wisconsin. It's easy to control that, but it's a lot more difficult when you're having to provide from the actual nature. Nature just does nature.
Yeah, you know, well before all this was going on, you know, and then the challenges that we're facing of our foods not being USDA approved, I have always thought and said, you know, we couldn't prove our ptarmigan is much more healthier than the chicken itself. Our ptarmigan being a wild game that, you know, got its food out in the country. And earlier on, I've also mentioned that, you know, our resources out there and how we need to protect our resources out there from industry or, you know, or from being run over. You know, it's really protecting every little detail out there that can be eventually harmed by outside influences. And I've mentioned we couldn't quite prove our ptarmigan is a lot more healthier than the chicken itself. And the way the differences we see, how we see that is our ptarmigan is a wild game, takes care of itself out in the country, goes to and from. And it's not just so much locked up in one little cage its entire life for centuries and centuries and centuries compared to, I don't know much about chicken. I eat chicken. Yeah, there was a lot in my mind before we got this up and started. And I guess it helps me out for you to ask, you know, what I might be missing, where I might go from there, what more I might need to include on some of this subject. I know I kind of got a little off track. I'm just one of those people that feel like I need to give back to our elders, you know, to the people before us, to our ancestors who took really well care of these lands and waters. They didn't leave any evidence of harm behind. They didn't over-harvest any types of mammals out there, but for it to continue to, the cycle to continue. But we're facing these challenges today with a lot of outside interest folks coming in to overrun our lifestyle, basically.
So how, again, then, in the face of that, how are you, I don't know the best word for it, but how do you personally and you as your community, are you trying to
resolve that.
Tackle this, to resolve this. Yeah, that's the best word. Thank you. How are you trying to resolve this?
You know, in today's world, we do have meetings with the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service. We have fishing meetings with the Alaska Department of Fish and Game. So we have ANOs, Alaska Native Organizations. So all that is really taking place. So at the Alaska Department of Fish and Game level, let's say, for instance, the Western Arctic Caribou is our main source of meat that roams this country within the Northwest Arctic. And they do, right now as we speak, they're heading down south to winter. In order for them to head down south, they're running right through Kotzebue, and then a lot of them are out in the areas around Unit 23, which is the Northwest Arctic. And of course, some of them do go more south than here and winter there, but come springtime before calving season, they'd be heading back up north. So it's just a cycle that just goes on and on and on. So the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, they do keep track of the population levels, the habitat. We do have Western Arctic Caribou Working Group meetings, which is a diverse group of people. We do have our local people, our local hunters. We have the Alaska Department of Fish and Game, biologists and regulators, and just as well as the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service, the sport hunters, the guides, you know, just pretty much everybody all together within the meeting to oversee the harvest management plan and what's the next best step to go from there. Or even some conflicts that the local people are having are able to at least speak out. A lot of times we don't quite get our way because, well, I'm not too sure if I should say because, but when we say the state, I've always thought that's me. I've always thought that was me. You know, there's a lot of high interest groups from outside the state that supports the state government, you know, to override our decisions in many cases. So those are the big challenges that we're facing. That's just caribou for one instance. Within those meetings, you know, we've shared that information, what we observed, what we're able to see with the declining caribou. We've spoken over and over that the population of bears are rising. They're in areas where they haven't been before, just as well as the wolves, you know, and they are predators. So with the state fish and game and the federal side should help do something about it. But, you know, there's a lot of challenges that we face within the federal side of it, which they're not allowed to do to disturb population statuses and so forth, you know. But yet again, on the state side, it's a little bit different. You know, they could possibly do help, you know, prevent overpopulation of certain animals and so forth. So there's that one size doesn't fit all, you know, but those are what we've got to deal with. And many times we might, as far as when I say we, it's the local people. We are very seldom heard. We are outnumbered. We rely heavily on these foods, the wild game, for our source of food. There's no sport into it. We take the meat before we take the antler. The antler is probably the last thing we're going to take out in the field. So those are the huge differences that we face.
As we wrap this up, what brings you joy, or what brings your community joy? And with all we talked about, what positivity do you see on the horizon, or do you see now and around all this, you yourself or people that you interact with?
That's a great question. And that, again, too, is also a challenge. So the way I see it, you know, when we're able to harvest successfully and able to put food on the table, able to put food in storage, able to share our catch, that's spiritually, that's joy right there in itself already. The challenges that we're facing, we just described about all the other details, such as climate change, such as the high interest rate of outsiders coming in, you know, to our territory. I think we lost out on that one. I was too young to vote at the time. I lived out in the country. We were out of reach of communication living out in the country, but we were people that were still living somewhat a nomadic lifestyle. But of course, you know, it came to the point to where we had this generation is right in the center of living in two worlds, living in the subsistence way of life and also living the Western culture. So we've spoken a lot about this, our subsistence life, about how we're able to follow the seasons, gather, store, prepare food. We're wealthy native people, just as long as we had a roof over our head and food on the table, we had it made. We're good. But of course, with the challenges that we start facing today is living in two worlds, living both the subsistence lifestyle and Western culture, and trying to be in between those. So in order to keep up with technology, which is transforming from my dog team to a snow machine or a boat, the snow machine and a boat needs gas, oil, and of course you need a boat, you need a job to get that. So we didn't quite have that. We had the roof over our table, over our head, and food on the table, but something was missing. There was a limited amount of boats that everybody would get together on over at camp and then, you know, do a harvest in some sort. But with today's challenges that I see is that they're very much needed today following through with technology. We needed to pay the bill, right? So I needed to come to work, come into town to find a job, right? In order to do that. So yeah, by the grace of God, I found this job within Manila that fits me really well, which is the Hunter Support Program. And so I've been with it I started this program back in 93, and I am looking forward to be retiring here within next year or two. And once I retire, it's not like I'm just going to stop anything. I'm heading back out in the country.
Yeah.
As long as I still could move around, right?
What are you most looking forward to with your retirement then?
You know, I've been planning on it, and I've been watching I've been trying to watch my retirement and see where I'm going to fit, where I'm going to be, you know, just kind of planning ahead, right? So I've been trying to prepare myself with some stuff that I might need, that I might, you know, once I get on a fixed income, I'm not going to be able to get some stuff that, you know, I should have. I do have a cabin over in Sisolit that I built in my early 20s. I built a cabin over there, and I'm still living in it today. But then, of course, with a lot of issues that it's starting to have, you know, getting old and rotting and cold and stuff like that, right? I mean, I can't quite fit well into a whole old house such as that, you know, to be comfortable. I'm gonna slow down drastically to the point to where I couldn't do the stuff that I did before when I was younger, such as chopping wood, hauling water. You know, I'm gonna still do it. I'm just gonna slow down. Right now, I'm in the process of building another cabin over there, which is about halfway. The shell is more than halfway done, and I'll finish it up this spring. Setting myself up for retirement, looking ahead, right? I mean,
that's a great way to finish. Unless there's anything else.
Yeah, this is just my voice. It's not, this really came from just myself. Nobody told me to, nobody told me not to. So it's just my point of view, not necessarily the region's.
Absolutely. And we really appreciate you sharing your own personal perspectives on everything. Thanks so very much again to Cyrus for talking with me. I particularly enjoyed chatting with him. He does just such a fantastic job speaking about his work and his perspectives on everything going on up in Kotzebue and beyond. The way in which traditional Arctic worlds interact with the Western world, you know, for better or worse, is something which I find especially important. And Cyrus just describes that so well.
Yeah, that's such a great point. And I feel really fortunate to have had the experience of getting to sit in a hotel lobby in Nome with Cyrus at the end of our last all-teams meeting with all the search contributors. And we were getting ready to go to the airport, and we just had already checked out of our rooms, and we were waiting for the shuttle. And he and I, Cyrus and I, got to talk about a lot of what he spoke about today in the podcast, about his work and harvesting and sharing traditional foods with Indigenous elders, as we ate imported bananas. You know, I'm a big fruit eater myself, so it was just fascinating, as you say, to be able to share food together in the Arctic, but definitely not traditional Indigenous foods, no way. So yeah, there's just an endless matrix of those intersections and overlaps of the traditional worlds interacting with the Western world. And yeah, the more we can bring those to light, the better, I think. So fantastic conversation today. Thank you, Alex. Thank you, Cyrus. And yeah, we look forward to hearing much more from Cyrus as we move ahead with all of the search project.
Yeah, what a combination of worlds to get bananas into a lobby in Nome.
Yeah.
That's fantastic.
Just thinking about the economics and the logistics that would require that. Yeah, I was happy because I bought them early on in the trip in Nome, and then I let them ripen in my hotel room so that they were, you know, not hideously green when I tried to eat them. So yeah, it was great.
Arctic ripened tropical fruit.
Yeah, exactly.
It's a very unique subset of food on the planet.
That might have to be an entirely additional episode, actually. Yeah.
Yeah, we'll talk about that.
Yeah.
Stay tuned, all.
Yeah, stay tuned, all. All right, well, thanks so much, Alex and Cyrus. This brings us to the end of this episode of Out of the Arctic. Thank you so much for listening. We want to thank you, the listeners, for joining us for this episode of Out of the Arctic, a podcast from SEARCH, the study of environmental Arctic change. You can learn more about everything we discussed today by checking out this episode's show notes at searcharcticscience.org. Out of the Arctic can be found anywhere you listen to podcasts. We look forward to you joining us next time.